Good evening, everybody. You're listening to episode 19 of the Laser Guided Melodies podcast. I'm Ed Biggs, and you probably noticed if you listened to any of our previous episodes that Lauren is missing because she's normally the first person to speak. Lauren is busy this time around, but in place we do have somebody who's been working for us for the last year but hitherto been in the shadows somewhat. He's Matthew Langham.
Evening.
So Matt, you've been writing for us since January, but you've only just come onto the podcast now. Why?
Basically, I spend a lot of time in Hull for the weekends. That's kind of the reason why.
Go to Hull?
Yeah, I'm from there originally. Big Hull City fan. Yeah, been alright in a minute, City.
We've all got our faults, I suppose. Right, so in the interest of getting to know you a bit better, tell all our lovely listeners what your favourite bands are, what kind of music you specialise in.
It's absolutely all sorts, to be quite honest. When I was younger, kind of grew up on the Specials, so kind of massive fan of them. Anything ska related, Britpop, reggae.
I usually see you wearing sort of Modest Mouse and Domino Records and Pavement kind of t-shirts normally.
Yeah, it's a lot of that as well. Kind of grew up absolutely all sorts of music, and obviously my music taste kind of developed from when I was young to now, really. So it's kind of a really broad range of artists.
Yes. Normally when you write for us, you're very, what's the word, measured. In your sense, there's never really any sort of glowing nines, but there's not many sort of 3 out of 10s either. You're very sort of Mr. 6 out of 10.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to give an artist a 9 out of 10, it's obviously got to be an absolutely fantastic album, like probably one of the greatest possibly. So I think to give a band a really high score, it's kind of got to be measured, and it's got to be like really considered as well.
Yeah, well, perhaps I need to give you better sort of worse or better albums to review in the future. Right, so let's get cracking. Albums we'll be reviewing on the show this week are Weezer's Everything Will Be Alright in the End, Ben Howard's I Forget Where We Were, Flying Lotus's You're Dead, and the Twilight Sad's Nobody Wants to Be Here and Nobody Wants to Leave. And in the classic album section, we'll be looking at Kraftwerk's Autobahn, which turned 40, and it's the album that's generally considered to be the what sort of turned Kraftwerk into the band that we all know and love. And then the Smiths' sort of B-sides collection, Hatful of Hollow, which turned 30. Sorry, it will be turning 30 in a couple of days' time. So, bit of news first of all. Last week, Mercury Music Prize, and it was Young Fathers who won. Mm. What did you reckon to, I suppose, Young Fathers winning and the ceremony?
I think it's a massive surprise, really. I think obviously the bookies had Kate Tempest and who's the other one they had?
FKA Twigs.
Yeah, FKA Twigs. So it's a massive shock, really. But I think Young Fathers, it's an absolutely fantastic album. It wasn't considered to be one of like the highest rated, but it definitely deserves it on merit.
Yeah, I mean, it came out all the way back in February, so I reviewed it at the time, gave it 7 out of 10. It just kind of passed me by a little bit. It just seemed to be another album that was out at the time. And the list of nominations itself was quite a varied bunch, and there were bands like Churches who missed out, who probably could have felt hard done by. So it was a bit out of left field, just the selection. And I guess it's a left field selection from a left field list.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's a good album, but it's kind of when you listen to it again, knowing that it's won the Mercury, somehow it sounds a bit better because you know that other people love it too.
Yeah, I really wanted Anna Calvi to win, so I was kind of a bit disappointed, but on the first
I did as well, actually. Yeah. I've seen Anna Calvi a few times live, and yeah, she's just a great performer. And the last person who got nominated for their first two albums was James Blake, and he won last year, so that her album was the only one in that list that was released in 2013, not 2014. So, surprising to see it on that list.
I always like the Mercury's because there's always like some artists that you haven't really heard of. Obviously, this year was a Polar Bear Club. I think they called that
Polar Bear.
Polar Bear, sorry.
Yeah, and Go-Go Penguin.
Yeah, it's really, really brilliant music which I've not heard of before. So I think just like having them on the list is absolutely fantastic.
Oh, they're just token jazz nominations. They're always on the list, but they're never going to win, are they?
Not really, but it's still great to hear the music.
Yeah. The only genre they never really put on is metal, I think.
Yeah.
And there's always criticisms of the Mercury's, and you know, it's a cabal of sort of unaccountable music critics sitting in their sort of critics' cave right up until the end. But it is better than just the music industry circle jerk that's the Brit Awards and or the NME Awards, where they just give everything to Arctic Monkeys and Muse and Biffy Clyro. Next piece of news, the John Lewis Christmas advert is coming out in the next couple of days. I think it's probably going to be on Friday night's episode of Gogglebox. If you're listening to this and it's past Friday, you know, you probably have seen it already. But yeah, this year's song is going to be by Tom Odell. Your reaction?
Having seen the advert, I wouldn't have realised it was Tom Odell, simply because I don't particularly know his music, but I think the music piece of music just fits the video, just video clips just fantastically well. It's just really good cover of a John Lennon song, which I really liked it, actually.
Are you sure it's not just a breathy sort of cover, just like Lily Allen from last year? It's such a formula to just say, oh, we'll pick a classic song that everybody loves and get somebody to just sing hauntingly, quote unquote.
I mean, in terms of record companies, they have a massive influence into the advert and to the way the kind of song is presented. So I think that kind of has a massive impact on it. But I think it'll do. Obviously, it'll do really, really well.
It'll get to number
one. Yeah, get to number quite easy, I think. But I really enjoyed the kind of the advert and the way it's kind of presented. Really, so I quite like it.
Yeah, you're the first one. I don't like John Lewis Christmas. Sorry, I'm not a Grinch. I just hate John Lewis Christmas advert. Right, I'm sure we'll all be heartily sick of Tom Odell in the next couple of months. Let's crack straight on with the albums then. First up is Weezer's ninth album, Everything Will Be Alright in the End. Here's a clip of one of its lead singles, Back to the Shack. I got that disco sucks. I ended up with nobody and I started feeling dumb. Maybe I should play the lead guitar and Pat should play the drums. Take me back, back to the shack. With the lightning strap, kicking the door, more hardcore, rocking out like it's 94. Let's turn up the radio, turn off those stupid singing shows. So you've just been listening to a clip of Back to the Shack from Weezer's ninth album, Everything Will Be Alright in the End, which was released a little over a month ago. Matt, what did you think of the song and the album?
I quite like the song, but I've never been a particularly big Weezer fan. They've kind of never really appealed to me. So I saw them live a few years ago and they're pretty good, but in terms of this album, it's not really kind of just tick the box for me, so yeah, I'm not a particularly massive fan.
And the thing is, I loved Weezer in the 90s. Their first two albums are probably two of the best examples of what turned into emo eventually. Heart on the sleeve sort of power pop, which is kind of like sort of shy as well in a way. It's great for teenage boys. Their decline and collapse through the noughties for me has been just one of the most mysterious processes in musical history. Like I said, Blue Album, Pinkerton were amazing, and then things kind of started to go wrong with the Green Album, which when they came back after a 5-year gap in 2001, which is just a pale copy of the first stuff. And then that Beverly Hills song, do you remember that?
Awful
song. It's so crass, and just, they just turned into a frat boy band, and it really spiralled out of control there. It got as bad as Ratitude in 2009, which is just awful. It's a crime against music. I mean, Rivers Cuomo was pushing 40 and he was still singing about having frat parties and sleeping with college girls. It was disgusting.
I remember Hurley, that was quite interesting.
Oh, fuck. But that's how they tried to address the problem, by making an album that was so vacant they actually named it after a character from Lost. Just so they had nothing to say. And just to think that was from a band who once made, that once made Pinkerton and Only in Dreams. It was such a collapse from such high points. They're one of the very few bands who've made a 10 out of 10 and a 0 out of 10 in their career, I think. But yeah, so despite this, they've always been bafflingly popular. I mean, this album's their seventh US top 10 in a row. Basically, they've tried to arrest this decline, but they've appointed Rick Ocasek, who used to be a member of The Cars, and he produced the Blue album and the Green album, just to try and sort of sonically get back to where they were, try and get some of that bite back into their sound. And I don't know, it's just, it works, but only to a very limited extent. I mean, that Back to the Shack song, that was decent.
Yeah.
And you, the first couple of tracks, you think, yeah, this, you know, it's Weezer, they're back.
It's very sort of like radio friendly, I think. I've heard it on the radio quite a few times.
Yeah, but it's very shiny, and that eventually it just gets to the point where you just think it's that they're working to a formula, which is loud guitar plus a little bit of melody equals that'll do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not good. There's one song written with Justin Hawkins from The Darkness, and that's just as ridiculous as you'd think it would be. Yeah, there's just too much chugging averageness here, and I gave it 4 out of 10. I thought it was very disappointing. Everyone seems to love it for some reason. It's got 76% on Metacritic.
Interesting.
But no, can't see that. Sorry, Weezer. But it does suggest they're looking in the right place.
Yeah.
To try and rediscover their sound. Okay, next album is Ben Howard's I Forget Where We Were, which was released a couple of weeks ago and was number one in the UK album charts last week. This is a clip of End of the Affair. In love again. Now I talk about you when I'm with our mutual friends. Now I water running round in love again. That was End of the Affair from Ben Howard's second album, I Forget Where We Were. What did we think of this?
I quite enjoyed it. I mean, I saw Ben Howard at Glastonbury a few years ago, and the crowd was enormous. I couldn't believe it. Like, it's obviously really, really popular, but in terms of the album, I quite enjoyed it. It's quite different to his first album. But yeah, quite liked it.
Yeah, I saw him at Latitude, I think in 2012. And yeah, it was just so packed out. I hadn't really heard of him before, but I had heard of that song. What's the...
Only Love?
Yeah, that's it. But this album's really good, I think.
Yeah.
It's much darker, and he sort of takes a bit more time to let his ideas sort of percolate a bit.
Definitely, yeah.
And, you know, these songs are like 8 minutes long. I can't really see how the teenage girls who loved him so much first time around are going to be sort of challenged a bit more this time around.
I think it's a bit less popular than it was maybe on the first time, but as you say, it's a lot darker than his debut, I think.
Yeah, I mean, he's actually sort of cashing the check that he'd written with his first album a bit, trying to, you know, all his influences like the Fairport Convention and stuff like that. Yeah, it's good, not great. I mean, there's a couple of duds on the album, I think.
Yeah.
But it's a good, solid 7 out of 10 kind of record. I was very impressed with the structure. I think it just sounded a bit more like Richard Hawley. You know, that Standing on the Sky's Edge album, just these long songs take a while to build up. You can kind of tell it in the artwork as well. It's just him in a black and white shot, sort of with half his face in the shadow. You think, where's all the pop gone? You know, where's all the multicolour, where's all the sort of festival sing-alongs? And it's very indicative of what sort of lies within. It sounds a bit like Duruti Column as well, I think.
It is a little bit, actually. But if you were going to give it like a one-word review, I'd probably call it solid. I think that's pretty much how I'd describe it.
Yeah. If you were to review it, I'm guessing you'd probably give it 6, wouldn't you?
Probably, yeah.
No, I think he deserves a bit more credit for actually pushing the boat out and using his platform as an opportunity to challenge people.
Definitely, yeah.
Which is really good to see. So, yeah, welcome back from the cold, Ben Howard. No way. We like you now. Right. Next one. It's Flying Lotus with You're Dead. And this is a clip of the Kendrick Lamar featuring Never Catch Me. I can see the darkness in me and it's quite amazing. Life and death is not history and I want to taste it. Step aside of my mind and you'll find curiosity. Animosity, high velocity, I can prophesize meditation. Reminisce on my wonder years and I wonder, yeah. Sentiments of my words ain't been so sincere. It's intimate to my nerve that I just persevere. The big thought of falling off disappear to my faith. They say their head is real. Analyze my demise, I say I'm super anxious. Recognize I deprive this fit and then embrace it. Okay, so that was Never Catch Me from Flying Lotus's album You're Dead. This was quite a special record, wasn't it?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, it was, there's so many different influences on there, like just like experiments of jazz, there was R&B, hip hop, so many different sort of elements to it that I really enjoyed. I think it was definitely deserved like of a 10 out of 10 record on that basis.
Did you see the promotional video that came out for it?
I've not seen it, actually, no.
It's probably out there somewhere, but I saw it when it was streaming. It was streamed for 24 hours somewhere, and with it was this really bizarre sort of cartoon film that went along with it. And it was just so sort of indicative of, sort of the content that sort of lay beneath. Anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. For those of you who don't know who Flying Lotus is, he's a Los Angeles-based performer and producer called Stephen Ellison, and he's made a host of well-received albums since he began in 2006. Eventually, it gave him the chance to sort of curate a radio station on Grand Theft Auto 5, which is called Fly Low FM. And he's also the great-nephew of Alice Coltrane, the legendary jazz pianist. So he does have sort of jazz in his blood.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. There you go. So this album called You're Dead with an exclamation mark on the end is a meditation on the inevitability of death and sort of the intrigue and the mystery of what sort of lies beyond our life. I mean, the stuff he's done before has been excellent, but this is just something else entirely.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so short as well, isn't it? It's 18 tracks long and it's just under 40 minutes.
Yeah,
in length.
Yeah.
He really rattles through them quickly, and he's got a host of collaborators on there like Snoop Dogg, Kendrick Lamar, like you just heard, even Herbie Hancock.
It's really interesting.
It's a great mixture of, like you say, alternative R&B, jazz, electronica.
Mm.
If you can get hold of it, it's really worth a listen. We gave it 10. It is one of the albums of the year, unquestionably, and probably of the decade so far. Absolutely mind-blowing. He just never lets an idea get old. He just moves it along so quickly, I think. Is this your kind of music normally, would you say?
Not particularly. I mean, at first I found it a little bit weird, but I kind of got into the album a little bit more as it progressed, and you kind of become to realise like there's so many like different influences in there, as you say, it relates to like the famous jazz musician. So that kind of makes sense, really. So as it kind of went on, I kind of really enjoyed it, and yeah, it deserved a 10 out of 10 record.
Mm. It isn't really our forte, this sort of music, I have to admit, but I was so struck by it. Mm. Usually, as you can guess, we're two white guys in our 20s, so we all like indie music, basically, and guitars, but we can appreciate the finer things too. Guess there's not much more to say about that. It did quite well in America, made the top 20 in the billboards, did quite well here as well, number 24, which was not bad at all. Yeah, so let's move on, shall we?
Yeah.
next album, final featured new album is The Twilight Sads, Nobody Wants to Be Here and Nobody Wants to Leave. They're a Scottish four-piece, who are kind of like editors in Interpol, aren't they?
Yeah.
But they're better than editors and Interpol. This is a clip of There's a Girl in the Corner. So that was a clip of There's a Girl in the Corner from the Twilight Sad's fifth album.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody Wants to Be Here and Nobody Wants to Leave. We have a bit of a disagreement in the studio here. What did you think of it, first of all, Matt?
Personally, I thought it was just really, really boring. I kind of got halfway through the album. I thought, shall I really listen to this? It was kind of one of the type of albums. But there was elements of it, as you say, editors and Interpol, I think, like definitely sort of like leaning towards them sort of bands. But yeah, generally, I don't particularly like it, really.
But they were better than those sorts of bands. Better than White Lies and than Interpol. I mean, okay, basically, in your tier of sort of Joy Division copyists, there are three sort of subsections. There's Interpol, who are a poor man's Joy Division. There's editors, who are poor man's Interpol. and White Lies, who are a poor man's editors. Twilight Sad are probably about the same level as Interpol, I'd say.
Maybe. I probably call the editors more Wedding Present, maybe, than Joy Division.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. Basically, they've come back from the kind of industrial leanings of their last album, 2012's No One Can Ever Know, back there. And they've come back to more sort of traditional sort of post-punk territory.
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of feels like an album that's kind of out of time a bit, because the time for post-punk revivalism was 2005, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So it kind of feels like it's just not really... It's a bit late.
Yeah, exactly. I couldn't put it in better, really. It kind of feels of that time, and maybe a little bit too late. Really.
I just thought it was a bit more of a brooding atmosphere. It sounded a bit more like Mogwai. There was elements of that in there, just the noise and the power. They weren't throwing shapes like White Lies and Editors seemed to... Editors and White Lies seemed to be just like a tribute band.
Yeah, perhaps.
But Twilight Sad, and a bit of Arab Strap in there as well, like the deliberately sort of miserablest sounds that are going on in there. It's a very morose album, this new one, I have to say. But I think this thing's really good. It's kind of predictable, but very, very solid.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Very predictable, but...
I think you kind of persuaded me a bit. It's not the most original. I gave it 8 in my review. Possibly I'd revise that. I don't know. But there's more content in there. There's emotion. There's catharsis, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I would have maybe given it a 4 or 5. Maybe on the fence.
That's harsh. Okay, we'll have to leave it at that one. Let's crack on with a bit of Kraftwerk. Everybody loves a bit of Kraftwerk. This is Autobahn from the album of the same name, which was released 40 years ago last week. Wir fahren, fahren, fahren auf der Autobahn. Fahren, fahren, fahren auf der Autobahn. So that was a 30-second clip from a 22.5-minute song called Autobahn by the German legends Kraftwerk. That was released 40 years ago today. What do you think of it?
It's just a staple classic, really. I mean, it's fairly hard to believe it's 40 years old, really, just because it just kind of runs down to the music industry so close. I mean, if you look at bands like Temples, they kind of use that type of music, so it's just a staple classic, really.
Yeah, I find it hard to think of a moment in pop like this, which was just so completely without precedent.
Yeah,
there's absolutely nothing like this in 1974, and when it was released, it kind of got received as a novelty song. It did quite well in the British charts. You know, to the record buying public's eternal credit, it got to number 11 in the charts. The single did anyway, not the album. But I think it's a commonly held misconception of pop music that the two most influential bands in the world are the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. That's only half true. If you didn't have the Rolling Stones, all that would be different now is that you'd have fewer posh boys playing dress-up rock and roll. You wouldn't have Mumford and Sons and you wouldn't have the Vaccines. I mean, that's no big deal. But if there was no Kraftwerk, it's kind of... It's hard to imagine what music would sound like now. I mean... Those sounds would be... They've probably been discovered by somebody else.
Absolutely,
but not until much later. And certainly wouldn't have been arranged in the same way. And that was Kraftwerk's kind of real legacy, I think, how to arrange those new sounds. Because you can hear the DNA of club music and hip-hop
absolutely.
In Kraftwerk.
If you look at Kraftwerk and Neu, for that matter, their sort of influence has been massive on music. More Kraftwerk, I guess, but... If you look at the bands nowadays, they kind of use that kind of similar sort of patterns of rhythm, and it kind of links on Kraftwerk, really. So you can kind of see their influence in modern day rock music, I guess, not just kind of electronic music.
I mean, because Africa Bambaataa famously sampled Trans Europe Express, which was a Kraftwerk single from a couple of years later. And some of the very first hip hop artists, you know, they all sort of mentioned Kraftwerk in interviews as being sort of a key influence. So, yeah, Germans invented hip hop. But I think you need to put this album in its correct context. Kraftwerk had been around for a while, and they'd made three albums before this, which were they were all instrumental. Kraftwerk didn't do any singing until this album, and all they sing is "Wir fahren, fahren, fahren on die Autobahn." It's hardly profound or anything, but it's the point at which they started evolving from just another kind of krautrock band to the band that we kind of associate them with now. They'd always operated through improvisation in the past, just these long song collages that they kind of edited down and rationalised into sort of very long mood pieces. But this sounds more planned and structured, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
It kind of revisits those sort of musical running, those sort of the musical themes, the melodies, and it revisits them later on in the song, and it never quite resolves itself. It's just supposed to mimic this long journey on the Autobahn, which and the Autobahn famously has no sort of exits or anything like that. It's just a long straight piece of road. So I know that makes the song sound really boring, but it's supposed to be boring.
Yeah,
kind of artistically.
Yeah, it's got that kind of like monotony behind it. The Autobahn.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to pick out just a 30-second clip for you, but unfortunately, that's how we're sort of restricted here. But it's worth tracking down. Kraftwerk themselves would go on to make better albums, I think, certainly, like The Man Machine and Trans Europe Express. But this is the sound of a band driving off into the future on a gilded, golden sonic highway and just leaving everybody else in the dust. The key influence came when people like Bowie and Brian Eno kind of discovered it.
Jumped on it a bit, didn't they? Yeah.
And Joy Division and Public Image Limited and used it in kind of post-punk. And then you can hear it in the synthetic pop in the 80s, like Human League and Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark and Simple Minds and all that. Just it's a point in a family tree at which just loads of branches start sort of going off from it. And that doesn't sound particularly coherent, but it's a great song, and it just sounds so completely out of place in the musical context of the time.
I mean, like as you say, like OMD, their kind of influence on it as well. Like we like tracks like Electricity and like Another Gear.
I love Electricity; it's great.
It's just like so clear their sort of like Kraftwerk sort of influence on there. It's just like so patently obvious.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess we better wrap this up now. But Kraftwerk would make better albums than this, but I think you'd be hard pushed to argue they ever made a more influential record than this. Yeah, let's crack on. Last thing we've got to deal with, the Smiths, Hatful of Hollow, which turned 30. Is going to turn 30 on the 12th of November. We've got a clip of Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now, and we'll be back afterwards. I was looking for a job, and then I found a job, and heaven. So that was Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now, a 1984 single by The Smiths, which landed up on Hatful of Hollow, which was their second release, but not a studio album. Explain, Matt.
Basically, it's kind of just a bunch of John Peel sessions and a lot of different sessions mixed together, really. Personally, my favourite version of What Difference Does It Make is from the Peel sessions. I think it's just a bit more natural, a bit more kind of...
It sounds a bit choppier, doesn't
it? Yeah, it's a bit more choppier, a bit more sort of rock and roll, I guess, which I kind of really like.
I mean, Morrissey famously doesn't like the original, which is from their debut album, which we talked about a few months ago when that turned 30. But this kind of does count as an album, doesn't it? I mean, it was on Rolling Stone's 500 best albums.
The top ones, yeah.
And it is kind of well remembered, I think.
I think it just kind of proves how much of a brilliant live band they were. I mean, if you look at the sort of Peel sessions, they're absolutely brilliant. Just having them in there just kind of highlights just their kind of influence on the music industry and just how great a band they were, really.
Mm. But it is all, like you said, it's also home to Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now, which is not a single that appears on any other Smiths album. Yeah. So it's kind of like an odds and ends album, but it's more essential than I'm Making It Sound, basically. Definitely. It's also worth mentioning Louder Than Bombs kind of falls under the same category as well. That was kind of a B-sides album, but also some other singles have got mixed up in there, didn't it? It should be a footnote in the Smiths' legacy, but it's more important than that.
Definitely.
And that it goes to, for me, it illustrates just the cult of fandom that surrounds bands like the Smiths, that just something like this that should be on paper quite inessential got devoured and sort of loved so much by Smiths fans who were just eager to devour anything that they released.
That's it. I mean, like any sort of rarities, them type of bands just kind of, them type of fans loved it, really, and they still do now, so it just kind of proves the worth, really.
Do you reckon that was the start of sort of indie music as we know it? Because famously they were signed to Rough Trade, which is an indie label.
Perhaps, really, yeah, maybe.
So, well, the fandom side of it. I know when we say indie, a lot of people now kind of just think, oh, Travis and Star Sailor,
stuff. Yeah.
But in terms of indie, as in shorthand for independent music, the Smiths did kind of encapsulate it, but I guess they kind of began it as well, didn't they?
I guess so, yeah.
Started it. I know Factory Records were in the 70s, and they were an independent label. So, okay, not the start, but the apex, possibly.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at, like, Morrissey's performance on Top of the Pops at the time, like, he's wearing all, like, the spectacles, the
hearing
flowers
aid,
and all
yeah.
that kind of stuff. So it kind of brought that kind of indie music into like, the mainstream, really, so...
Yeah. I always thought it was kind of a cruel twist of fate that the Smiths were on... they were on an independent label, because it meant their chart positions always suffered, because when the Smiths released a single, it sold out so quickly, and because Rough Trade was so incompetent at getting their stuff together, it meant that these singles went out of print and they only ever got to like number 12 in the charts, where they probably all would have been at least top 3 singles and all their albums would have been number 1, whereas as it is, they only had one number 1 album. Okay then, so I guess that's it for this week. It's a very short episode this week, but normal service will hopefully be resumed by the end of the month. I'm going on holiday. Matthew here will be watching the ship. That's not the phrase, is it? Minding the ship? Matt will be taking care of everything. I'm going to be sunning myself, and Matt's going to be freezing in Leeds. Episode 20 will hopefully be with you by the end of November. On it, we shall be talking about the new Foo Fighters album, Sonic Highways, which is out on November the 10th. TV on the Radio's fifth album, which is called Seeds, I think, isn't it? Hookworms, who are a band from Leeds, and I think Matt's going to be reviewing that. And Calvin Harris, which was released this week, but I'm going to have to clear my schedule to just have a rant next time. It's going to be a good 5-minute one, I think. I'm getting angry just thinking about it. And then hopefully we'll be talking about albums by Superfood, Ariel Pink, Bass Drum of Death, Arca, Damien Rice, Neil Young, Royksopp, and the collaboration album between Paul Smith of Maximo Park and Peter Brewis of Field Music. Album anniversaries next time. They will be the Beatles' fourth album, Beatles for Sale, which will be 50 years old on 4th of December. And two on the same day, on the 5th of December, there are two albums turning 20, them being Pearl Jam's Vitalogy and the Stone Roses' ill-fated second record, The Second Coming. In the meantime, you can find us on the interweb by searching for laserguidedmelodies.co.uk. We'll only be occupying that domain name for the next couple of months because we are unveiling a brand new website, hopefully in January. You can also find us on Facebook by searching for the same thing. And on Twitter, we are at LG Melodies. Last Order of Business, I guess it's albums of the month.
Mm-hmm.
What do you reckon the best album of the last 4 months has been? I mean, I think it's an easy one this time, isn't it? Flying Lotus.
Yeah, quite easily. 10 out of 10.
Yeah. Ice Age's album was really good as well, I think. Ploughing Into the Field of Love.
Yeah, I've heard one track for that. It sounds really good, actually.
Yeah. A lot of trumpets and things and brass and strings being involved. A lot different to what they've done before. And in joint third, we had Run the Jewels, and their second album is out now. The Twilight Sad, I think, are deserving of joint third. And there's a new album by, I think her name is pronounced Tinashe, not to be confused with Tina Shea, with an accent on the E, who was kind of a crappy singer in the 90s. So that album is called Aquarius, and it came out a few weeks ago, and it's one of the pop albums of the year as far as I'm concerned. So, go bye, and goodbye.
Bye.